In this episode, I'm going to cover some, or respond, I guess, to a little bit of listener feedback. Specifically, Shadra on Mastodon said, "Fantastic discussion on GNU World Order episode 561, prompted by Dovecot about email, Nextcloud, and the challenges of communication on the modern internet. Regarding installing Nextcloud, I've had fantastic success using UnoHost. It has been fairly straightforward to install and maintain. I'd recommend it to anyone interested in giving it a go." And this is such a great point, and I thought that maybe I could do just an episode on UnoHost in case you, dear listener, have not heard of this before. I found out about UnoHost back in probably 2019-ish at a conference called Open Source Summit. It happened by their booth, was super impressed with the project, eventually ended up installing it on a laptop and running a couple of different services on it, and just had a little play around with it. And it was just really, really nice and really, really useful, like supremely useful. So what is UnoHost? UnoHost is a Linux distribution. It's as simple as that. If you've ever installed Linux, then this is not going to throw you for a loop. This is going to be really, really familiar to you. You download the ISO image, the install image from the internet. You put it onto a USB stick, for instance, and then boot a computer off of that, off of the USB drive, and you go through the steps to install it. Of course, big warning here that this is going to erase everything on that computer because you're installing a new operating system. So if you've never done that before, if you're not familiar with this, don't try to do anything fancy. Just to have a computer that you're 100% fine with erasing. All the data on that computer is going to go away. It's going to get replaced by a Linux operating system called UnoHost, UnoHost.org. That's where you get the image. So once you've installed it, then you reboot and it boots to a kind of a scary looking text screen. Like there's no desktop here. This is a server. This is designed as server software. And it does a really good job, UnoHost, of stepping you through each stage of setup. And it is really surprisingly simple, but obviously if you've never done it before, it might kind of be scary, but I mean, you can do it. You install it on the computer and then you reboot the computer and it boots up to its little login screen. And weirdly, you don't log in. You just go to another computer, like your normal computer that you would normally use. You launch a web browser and you go to the IP address that's written on your UnoHost screen, because it tells you what its IP address is and how to get to it. So you just type that in and log in. You complete the setup in a web browser on a different computer. It feels really weird, but actually that's not all that uncommon. People in like a data center or, you know, at an organization with an IT department, like you install stuff, you install the operating system on a server. A lot of times you don't even like interact with the computer. You just like boot the computer to like either a network image, or maybe you're booting it off of the USB drive or something, and a script runs and it installs the operating system, and then you log in from some other computer through a shell, through a terminal, and finish up the configuration. So UnoHost is kind of using a tried and tested methodology here of installing a server and then going away from that machine, because you're not really meant to interact directly with the machine. The idea is that you could take this spare computer and stick it in a closet or in your attic or just off in a corner somewhere, and it'll be running UnoHost, but you'll never actually like directly interact with that computer. You'll sit at your desktop or your laptop or on your couch or at your desk or whatever and just open up a web browser and interact with that computer remotely. So you do that. You open up a web browser. You point it at the IP address of UnoHost. Let's say it's 192.168.0.15. That's just an example. It could be anything. It could be 10.0.1.112. Like, who knows? It could be anything. But it literally tells you on the screen after you reboot, it tells you where to go. So you go to that computer and you log in and you finish the setup process. I think it might be 3 steps tops. I mean, it's really, really fast. It's not asking you for much. I think it asks you for a username and a password, to be honest. So it might only be 2 steps. So you might have to set up a domain during that step as well. But that's the next step anyway, conceptually. So UnoHost is designed as a public server. What it wants you to use it as is a server that provides internet-based applications, like, you know, cloud applications, essentially, except your cloud is just like your one computer, to people, to like people on the internet, maybe to random people, or maybe just to your family and friends. Like, it's up to you kind of how much you want to broadcast it and how much interaction you want to insist upon. You know, when someone tries to sign up for a new account for a service that you're providing, do you want to approve them yourself manually, or do you just want to open it up to everybody? It's up to you, but that's what UnoHost wants. UnoHost wants to be a publicly available internet server, like a server on the internet. And I'm saying this, I'm belaboring this point, because there are ways to not do that. You could run UnoHost as just a home server and have it just using a local domain name, like a, you know, mygreatsite.local, and it will mostly work, but what it really wants to be and what it expects to be is on the internet. So with UnoHost, with one click, you can install really, really big applications that would normally be relatively complex to install. Applications like Nextcloud, WireGuard VPN, Etherpad, the Discourse forum software, Jupyter like notebooks for Python, Pi-hole, the ad blocker, you can just block all the ads on your network, a Tor relay, the Element chat client in case you're on Matrix, Jitsi for video and audio chat, Jellyfin the media client, Borg backup, Roundcube email client, so you could have your own web-based email client, Git software like Gitty, Mattermost for chat, and on and on. You can see a big list of all of them at apps.unohost.org/catalog. The advantage here is that once you've got UnoHost up and running, which I've just described, you install it just like an operating system and then you log in through your web browser. Once you've got it installed, the installation of again, relatively complex applications is really just a click and then sometimes filling out one or two or maybe, I don't know, three or four fields of information that UnoHost cannot find an acceptable default for. This is a little bit different than administering a server just on your own. And experienced admins, I fear we frequently take a lot of this for granted. We think, well, you know, it's not really that hard to set up, I don't know, let's say Nextcloud. And the reason that we say that is because we don't think it's all that hard to configure a MySQL server and make sure that our PHP version is correct and making sure that we're in the correct directory and all that other stuff. And you might and untarring a package that we download, you know, like there are so many steps that we just kind of gloss over. And if you've ever used Linux, if you're a frequent Linux user, you do the same. We all do it, right? We gloss over all the stuff that we ourselves find trivial because that's not part of it, really, right? Well, yes, it is. Like if you had to then write down the steps for someone to replicate what you have just done, I challenge you to write just a one-step instruction. You know, like that's not realistic. One step in this process, that doesn't happen. There's going to be a minimum of two steps because you have to get the person in a terminal and then using a sudo command to install the package. But realistically, they're probably also going to have to then configure something. Even the Apache web browser, as I was discussing in the previous episode, even that, which you install really, you know, you just sudo DNF install, whatever they call it on Fedora these days, HTTPD probably, or Apache 2, whatever they call it. Well, yeah, it's installed, and yes, you get to the It Works page, but now you know you have to open up that config file because your Apache host doesn't know your fully qualified domain name. So, I mean, right there, there's a configuration step. Now, admittedly, in UnoHost, there may be configuration that you need to do, but in UnoHost, it's all happening in a web browser, in a little app store where you just click a button and tell it to install such and such. And maybe there's a text field down in the, you know, as part of the install process that you have to fill out because, again, UnoHost doesn't know exactly what you want necessarily, but all you have to do is type in the value. You don't have to like scrub through a config file, find the config file, look through the config file for the value that you think you want, interpret the cryptic comments that are that's kind of trying to describe what you're supposed to fill. You know, it's just, it gets really complex, and people, once you do it once or twice, you just think, oh, this is super easy, super obvious. I maintain, and I think a lot of people maintain, that that's not the case. It is not obvious, it's not easy, it's complex. Unohost makes it, I think, as simple as it possibly can. The price for that simplicity is flexibility. Unohost, like I say, it wants to be a public internet server. It expects to have a fully qualified domain name. It wants, it sometimes it'll throw an application at you that will just insist that it needs its own subdomain, for instance. And yeah, you could probably change that somewhere in a config file in real life, but this is Unohost and it doesn't give you that option. You have to fill in the fields, but that is a feature. That is a value add. That is the kind of experience that some people really, really want. And other people don't want, other people value sometimes, and other people don't value other times. You know, it's just, it's a thing, it's an option. And it's, I think it's a really, really important option, which is why I'm doing this episode about it. But I mean, this is the kind of experience that sometimes you just want that, you don't want the flexibility. What you actually want is the box off the shelf. You don't want to have to build the box yourself. You just want the box. You want to open it, and there it is. That's more or less what Unohost provides. Okay. So, you've downloaded Unohost, the image. Maybe you've installed it. Maybe you're going through the setup stage. And at some point, and I think it is during the setup stage, but it might be later, you might be able to, well, either way, you can add it later. But I mean, I think it might present you this upfront as well. You're going to be asked at some point, pretty early on, for a domain name, for a fully qualified domain name. And if memory serves, Unohost will let you configure it for a local, as a local domain for now. And like I say, if you want to, you can just run it as a home server with a .local, for instance, domain name, and that's fine. That'll totally work. But what Unohost really sort of is built for is to be out there on the internet. So the way to do that is to go get yourself a domain name. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. I've learned a hard lesson back when there were only like 25 domain names in the world, maybe not that far back, but you know, like at some point, like 10 years ago, 11 years ago, 15 years ago, it was kind of like, do you have an idea for a project? Okay, well, get a domain name for that project. Like, for some reason, stupidly, sort of subdirectories had fallen out of favor. I don't really know why, but it was just like this thing. You just had to, I mean, for a long time, subdirectories were very much in favor. People just would put something on a subdirectory of someone else's web server, and it was fine and normal. But then, for whatever reason, everyone was like, no, you gotta have a domain name for every idea you ever have. And I fell prey to that, which is why I have like New World Order and Slacker Media and Mixed Signal and all these other domains that I just need to really reduce them all into one place. And I still haven't done that, but I do need to do that sometime. So get a domain name. It doesn't matter what it is. Nobody cares. Nobody ever types in a domain name anyway. Just look at how people use the internet. They go to a search engine and they search for the thing that they want. That's all you need. Don't worry about the top level domain. It doesn't have to be a .com or a .net or a .org or a .whatever, XYZ, .info. It can be .international. It can be .biz. It can .me, whatever. It doesn't matter. Get whatever's cheap. That's Well, actually, be careful. If you get whatever's cheap, it might suddenly go up next year. They like to do that. They'll offer like really, really cheap ones. And then like 2 years later, it's like, hey, this is a premium domain now. And it's like $200 a year. So just get something that just seems middle of the road. But just get one. But buy a domain name. Trust me, it's worth it. So you've got your fully qualified domain name from webhosting.coop. And now, and you've got your Unohost, you need to get those two things. Remember what I said in the previous episode, and the episode before that, and the episode before that, and the episode before that. When you're doing stuff on the network, there's the stuff that you do here, and then there's the stuff that you do on the network. You can't ever just do one or the other, because they don't know about each other yet. So if you've got a domain name and you've got an IP address, they don't know each. They don't know that they exist, so you've got to put them together. The way to do that is when you're buying your domain name, there'll be like some kind of control panel with the registrar that you used, and it's specifically a DNS zone manager, and this is where you put in the IP address that you want to have listed next to that domain name in the big, you know, internet phone book that is the domain name system. Your IP address needs to be a public IP address, which is different, of course, than the IP address that's listed on your Unohost boot screen. That Unohost boot screen is just your local IP address. It starts with 192.168.0. whatever, or 10.0.1. whatever. That's your local IP address. You need the public IP address. How do you get the public IP address? We talked about this actually in the curl episode. So you can just do curl icanhasip.com, or just go to icanhasip.com. That's I-C-A-N-H-A-Z-I-P.com. And that returns the public IP address for your network. So you're going to create an A name or an AAAA name, depending on whether you're on IPv4 A name or IPv6 AAAA name. You're going to create that, point it at your IP address. Also create a CNAME record that points to the CNAME should be www dot followed by your domain name. And you're going to link that to your domain name. So the A name is the domain pointing to the IP, and the CNAME is the subdomain that also gets you to your domain name in this case. You might have to set up other CNAMEs. Like I say, some applications within Unohost want a subdomain. So kind of, you know, save your login information for this, first of all, especially because your IP address could change too. So, you know where you are, know how to get back here, and just kind of get used to the idea that, okay, you've got your A name, and that's your canonical authoritative domain name. And then you've got your CNAME, which are all the subdomain sort of configurations that you can do that point just to your domain, or to a domain and a subdirectory, as the case will eventually be. So CNAME, www.example.com, goes functionally to example.com. Okay, so now you've got a domain, and you got Unohost. So continue to set up Unohost through the web browser by, you know, including your domain name, which is it will ask for. And your domain name, of course, now knows what your IP address is. So your domain name knows how to get to your network. And the thing on your network, Unohost, knows what to respond to. That's why you've given it the domain name. There is still a break here, though. I said that the domain name is registered on the internet, and it knows how to get to your public IP address. But that public IP address is, of course, your network, right? So once it gets to your network, how does it know where on your network Unohost lives? Well, it doesn't, and you'll have to configure that yourself. The way that you configure this is going into your router or you know, whatever device has a firewall on it. It's usually your router. You go onto that and you create something. It's usually called, it's sometimes called NAT forwarding. That's network address translation forwarding, or maybe port forwarding, or sometimes it's even called like a virtual server. Sometimes it's called services or service type. There's lots of different reference points to this because, you know, every router practically runs its own firmware. So it's just anyone's bet as to what the manufacturer of that router and that the programmer of that firmware decided to call this function. But what you do is you set up a service, usually like HTTP would be the service, which of course you and I know listens on port 80. And you say that, hey, anything coming to the router at port 80, forward that traffic over to the local IP address of your Unohost device. That would be the 192.168.0.15 or the 10.0.1.112 or whatever you used to log in to like register to your Unohost device, to set it up rather. Whatever that is, that's the address of your little Unohost server within your network. So you're telling your firewall to accept traffic coming to port 80, expecting a website and finding instead a firewall. So we're saying, open that up and send, but focus all the traffic coming into port 80 just to this one device on my network. And that is the Unohost device. There are a couple of sort of surprises here sometimes. Like if you're on a network that dynamically assigns IP addresses, which most of them do by default, then your Unihost device theoretically could change its IP address, or it could have its IP address changed. So today it might be 192.168.0.15. And tomorrow it'll be that, and 4 days from now it'll still be that. But then let's say you have a guest over, and just at the moment that all of the leases are being renewed on your router, the DHCP leases, your guest comes over and turns on their phone onto your network, and they accidentally grab, they get assigned 192.168.0.15. And so now your Unihost has to find another address. Well, that's not a problem. You've got like 250 of them. So not a big deal. So it's 192.168.0.16 now. Well, that'll apparently break your entire setup. Now your domain is pointing to your public IP address, but your little firewall is saying, okay, well, you told me to forward it to 15, so here you go. Oh, there's nothing at 15 with the web server port open. Okay, I guess that doesn't work. So you may also have to mess around with your router and tell it to do static IP address assignment to this specific device. And that specific device would be your Unihost server. And typically it can recognize that by like its MAC address. I don't remember what that calls. What that stands for? Manufacturer, I don't know. Access code, I don't know, MAC address, I don't know what that stands for. But it's the little, you know, it's the code burned into the network card of a computer. So you can usually tell your router, hey, what I have set to 192.168.0.15 or, you know, 25 or whatever right now today, like take that and make that permanent, like reserve that address for that specific device. I typically do that on my home network. I do that for all of the important machines, like, you know, my desktop or the server, whatever server I'm running, or, you know, maybe a device for the TV or whatever, special devices that like kind of need to, where I want to know exactly where they are at all times, I'll just statically assign them an address. So you can do that to protect your local address from changing. You may have to do something similar to that for your public IP address as well. And that's kind of, that's a tricky one. There are services out there that monitor your public IP address. And when it changes, it updates things for you. Like it's dynamic domain names. So DYN DNS, for instance. There used to be one called noip.com. I don't know if they're still around, but there are different services that'll do that for you. And that's just in case your router, you know, maybe it gets shut off one day, or there's a power outage, or maybe you had to reboot it. Well, suddenly your internet provider assigns you a different public IP address, meaning that your domain now points to the wrong IP address. It's not a big deal. It's just that it won't work anymore. It's not coming to your router anymore. So it's kind of a big deal in that sense. Now, you could go to your domain name registrar, the place where you got your domain name, and update your IP address, but you do that like two or three times and it gets old real fast. So look into dynamic DNS if you're doing that. And while you do that, I'm going to go grab a cup of coffee. I mean, you should grab a cup of coffee too, don't get me wrong, but also look into dynamic DNS. We'll do that. We'll come back, finish up the show. I'm back and I have coffee. I hope you have coffee. And if you were looking into dynamic DNS, then you'll know. I mean, I actually use no-ip.com. I should have mentioned that before the coffee break. No-ip.com is what I've, no good reason. It's just the one that I found out about first and I just kind of never have left. But it's really nice. You can, they have, I guess, four different domains now. Hop2.org, zap2.org, sites spelled with a Y, and DDNS, like dynamicdns.net. And so you create like a a host name, you know, like a host name for that specific top level domain. You create that, you point it to your public IP address, and you can run software locally that'll ping no-ip.com if your address changes and so on, or you can just go in there and do it manually, whatever. But that's a quick and easy way to get a local, or to get a domain name pointing at your Unohost. So yeah, hopefully that's useful. So once you've got Unohost all configured, and if you set up Unohost without having a big internet domain, that's fine. You can change that later. It's all in the interface. It's really marvelously, like, I can't describe exactly how easy Unohost is. So if you had installed it, let's say, and you set it up, you're ready to go, you log into your Unohost admin, whether it's over your local network or through your big internet network connection, and it's the screen, the initial screen is pretty minimal. It's a big blank screen with like a menu on the left, and the menu is users, domains, applications, and then a bunch of admin stuff like system update and tools and diagnostics and backup. Important stuff, but I mean, not stuff that you're going to interact with on a daily basis. Although I guess, honestly, you're not really going to interact with Unohost on a daily basis, at least from the admin point of view. So users creates users on your Unohost box. Domains is where you would set your domain if you hadn't set it during the setup stage, or you can add other domains if you're running, you know, more than one domain off of this Unohost, which you can do because that's how like web servers work, like virtual hosts, like we were talking about for Apache. And then applications, and that's kind of where you're likely to go most of all. Applications is, I find it a little bit confusing because when you go there, it lists your installed applications, which may mean that you see nothing at all, which seems shockingly unimpressive. But over on the right of the page, there's a big green button that says plus install. And so that's the button that you go to find the applications that are available to install. When I first clicked there, I thought applications, thinking I was going to see the applications available to install, and that the big green button on the right was the button that you click when you see a application that you like. And it concerned me that there was nothing listed there. Eventually I clicked the install button and discovered that shows you the catalog of applications available to install. So when you go to the catalog or the install menu of your Unohost, this is it first displays a bunch of categories like synchronization and publishing and productivity and management, office, communication, small utilities, reading, multimedia, development, games, social media, system tools, Internet of Things, WAT, weird experimental or very custom stuff. Those are the categories, or you can just click all apps and just see everything that they have available. And that's kind of, for, I don't know, personally, that's kind of where I like to start, because then you really get a feeling of what's available. But obviously, I mean, if you know what you're looking for, then to be fair, it probably does make sense to go to a category. But then again, I mean, like, what does Nextcloud fall into? I don't really know. So I'm just gonna go to all apps, and then I'm gonna search for next. There it is, Nextcloud, right after Flarum, Next Generation Forum. Okay, that triggered the next first. But yeah, so here's Nextcloud, online storage, file sharing, blah, blah, blah. So I click on that big icon. It downloads the data about that application. It's not installing yet. It's just contacting the internet for like the rest of the thing, I think. Okay, so here's Nextcloud. It describes it as an open source on-premises content collaboration platform, team access, share and edit documents, chat and participate in video calls, manage mail, calendar, and projects across mobile, desktop, and web interfaces. Oh, and it gives you a little potential alternative line so that you know kind of what application you might be avoiding by using this. That's kind of nice. So this lists Apple iCloud, Dropbox, Google Apps, Google Docs, Google Drive, Mega, and Microsoft OneDrive. I think that feels pretty accurate. And then it lists some Unohost specific features. So in addition to Nextcloud core features, The following are made available with this package. You can integrate with Unihost users. So that you know how I said that there was that users entry in the menu, in the main menu? That adds users to your Unihost box, I said, meaning that you could add your partner to your Unihost box so that your partner could also log in and administrate Unihost. But that doesn't mean that your partner now has an account on every single application you ever install. Like Etherpad, oh, now they have an account. Well, actually, I don't think Etherpad uses accounts, but Discourse, now they have an account. No, Discourse has its own sort of user management. And so you'd have to, you know, when you want to go to Discourse, you go to Discourse and you create an account there. You don't just automatically, you're not now an admin of the server. You just happen to have an account on Discourse. Same goes for Unihost. The users in Unihost gives you access to Unihost. But with Nextcloud, because Unihost, the packager for Unihost, figured this stuff out and is now delivering it to you, you can say, if a user has an account on my Unihost box, also create an account for them in Nextcloud. So it's a little bit of a cost saving or a time saver, really. Also, allow one user to be the administrator. You can set that during installation. Allow multiple instances of this application. So you can have a Nextcloud for your family and a Nextcloud for your gaming group or whatever. And they're not the same Nextcloud. They're separate. They're different URLs, but Unihost doesn't care. It is isolating these instances so they don't interfere with each other. You can optionally access the user home folder from Nextcloud files. That's kind of amazing. Why is that amazing? Because Unihost, again, remember, it can host lots of different applications. So you could host an application that provides like a networked file system for your internal network. You could be sitting at home and you could take a great picture of your cat, just doing the cutest little thing that cats do. So you take a photo of that and you decide, oh, I should save that. So you drag that photo into your networked file system, like with your photos. That's where you keep all your photos. Now, really, that, of course, I mean, you're on the couch with your laptop. You've just saved this to your network storage drive. Well, that's your Unihost box by any other name. And then one day you're hanging out with friends and you realize, oh my gosh, I have to show my friends this my cat photo that I took. Well, wait, your cat photo is at home. You saved it on your Unihost box. Ah, but you have Nextcloud. So you log into your Nextcloud account. You go to Nextcloud files, like your little file manager within the Nextcloud interface, and you reach into your Unihost. You reach out of Nextcloud into your Unihost home folder, grab that cat photo from your photos directory, and show it to your friends. So that's really, really nice. Really nice feature. And then finally, you can serve .well-known paths for CalDAV and CardDAV. And I imagine that's very exciting, except I don't know what that means. But I imagine it's, I don't know, something about sharing DAV things, I'll bet. I'm not really sure. I mean, I probably should know, because I have configured a couple of DAV things before, but I just don't remember what it means. So anyway, so that's the list, you know, that's kind of like the features. It shows you like a screenshot of what you could expect from this web application and shows you the links if you want more information to find out more about Nextcloud. And then there's the install settings. By default, it has a bunch of stuff already configured for you. The label is going to be Nextcloud. Now you could change that. You could say Nextcloud_family, and you know, then later you're installing it for someone else and your Nextcloud_work group or whatever. Choose the domain. So again, if you have multiple domains or if you have subdomains set up, you can choose where you want it to go. By default, it'll just take your whatever domain name you've told it about. Choose the URL path after the domain. So for instance, /nextcloud would make sense, or /cloud/ my cloud, whatever you want to call it. that this is the place on your domain that this will exist. You don't have to have something there. You could create like a subdomain, cloud.migratesite.org or whatever, info, whatever, and just install it, you know, and just have that be the place. Or you could just say, okay, it's going to be migratesite.info/nextcloud. And then as promised in the feature list, there's a selection where you can choose what user you want to be the administrator of this, or you can leave it blank and settle that later, I guess, or maybe not. I don't know. I'm not sure. Doesn't say it's required, I don't think. I don't know. I'd have to test that out, and I'm not going to. Who should have access to this? And this is really nice. So you can either make this something that everyone going to your domain name would have potential access to. It doesn't mean they get automatic, you know, they can't just walk in and look at all your files, but they will see that Nextcloud exists. They'll have a login prompt. They could probably contact you for an account, that sort of thing. So if you want that to be the case, then visitors is what you want to set that to. But maybe that's not what you want. And what you actually want is really just the people who know that you have UnoHost. They're the people you want to give access to Nextcloud. So you could just do all UnoHost users. You could even restrict it more and just say all the admins. So, I mean, you know, if you've got a UnoHost and you just want admin users to have access to something, then you can set that. But I think generally for Nextcloud, probably all UnoHost users. And then what happens with UnoHost, if you just go to the domain, wherever UnoHost is installed, you just go to that domain, then you reach a UnoHost screen. Like you get a list of all the available applications. And from that UnoHost screen, you can go to individual apps, whether they're on subdomains or just in a subdirectory. And if you're a UnoHost, if you have a user account on UnoHost, whether you're you or whether you are someone who you've granted access, then you can log into UnoHost and you can get potentially even more applications. And that would be the case here. So if you said all UnoHost users have access to Nextcloud, then people go to they'll go to your website, migratesite.info or whatever it is, and then they'll log into UnoHost, and now they'll have a screen of a bunch of applications that maybe other people don't have. So it really is, it's up to you on just how, I mean, yes, the server is public, but how public are the services? That's up to you. So visitors lets anyone on the internet at least request an account, depending on, you know, every service is going to have its own sort of policy. Like if you have Nextcloud, and you can set that up to have a certain, you know, does anyone who just says, yes, I need an account, do they get an account? Or do you restrict who can get an account? Or do you manually audit that yourself? It's up to you per application. But in this case, you can say either all visitors can at least see that Nextcloud exists, or all UnoHost users can see and interact with it. You can then set whether you want to be able to access the user home folder from Nextcloud, either yes or no, and then should there be a system address book listing all users accessible to all users. Generally, I think the answer is generally yes to that, at least in my experience, because Nextcloud I've never set up a Nextcloud that's just been a general, like, anybody on the internet can just come onto Nextcloud. Like, I guess that could happen, absolutely. But I think if you're inviting people to a Nextcloud, then you're probably inviting people who are meant to be socially aware of one another. And so probably you want to have sort of interactions between them, so that they can invite each other to audio chats or video chats or to text chats, or share files with one another. That's kind of the intent, I think. At least in my experience, that has. I guess it's kind of like, you know, like they say, Google Drive. Like, you can share a document. Well, who do you want to share that with? Another Google user, or anyone who has the link, and you can go in and kind of configure that. The same thing with Nextcloud. You can share a document, and if that user is local to Nextcloud, then you could just share it with them and they'll be right there in the list. But if you want to just get a general, like, hey, someone wants to see this document, I want them to be able to see it, then you can get a separate link for that. But whether or not you even know there are other Nextcloud users, I feel like generally you should know that there are other Nextcloud users. I think it's a little bit, the design, I think, is meant to be social enough to have awareness that, yes, there are other people on this server. So I think generally yes would be the answer to that. But obviously it's up to you. And then finally, you click the green install button at the bottom of the screen, and that installs Nextcloud. It sometimes takes a while. I mean, Nextcloud is a big application. It's got to configure. It's got to make sure that PHP is the correct version. It's got to set up the database. It's got to install the database and then actually set up the database backend for Nextcloud and so on. So, I mean, it's a whole thing that you'll have to wait for, not forever, but it's not super instant. And then once you're done, then you're kind of done. You can click on that little house icon in the upper left corner to go back to your admin panel. And from that main admin panel, you can click user interface. And the user interface is that's the login for your site, for your Unihost site. And this is the central login point that users are going to see when they go to your domain. And for me, I mean, I've got Grist, GRIST. It's a spreadsheet application that's quite nice. And a Universal Media Server installed, and now Nextcloud. So I see the little options here, and if I click, for instance, Grist, then it takes me to a separate Grist login screen where I can log in with my account. Oh no, it does. Yes, it does. Sign in. So I log in there with my my Grist account, and now I've got my little little spreadsheet here. But I could also click on Nextcloud. I mean, in theory, I actually can't because it's still installing and I'm doing this in real time. So it's not there actually yet. I'm lying. But were I to do that, then I would be taken to the Nextcloud login screen, or maybe it bypasses it because I enabled local users as well. Either way, you end up at Nextcloud. So it comes with this nice little sort of menu of the services that are running on Unihost, and it's got a great little admin panel. And it's got a lot of options, but not too many options. And I truly believe that that's a huge selling feature of Unihost, is that restriction of just, this isn't a thing that you're going to build yourself. It is already built for you, and you are essentially opting in and out of running a service. You can run Nextcloud or you cannot run Nextcloud. Either way, you're going to run Nextcloud in a subdirectory of this domain, or you could make a subdomain, but you're going to, and then you you only have a couple of choices. What backend are you using on Nextcloud when you run it on Unihost? Are you using MySQL or SQLite 3? Guess what? You don't know. They never ask. It's just something that gets configured, and it's beautiful. What version of PHP are you using when you're running Nextcloud? Guess what? You don't know. It doesn't ask. And if you install some other service that needs PHP 8.2, which I assume exists, what's the current version of PHP? 8.3. So yes, 8.2 does exist. So you install something else that wants 8.2? Well then, not a problem. Unihost will just make that happen for you. So it's that there is a loss of sort of flexibility and configuration that maybe arguably possibly some admin out there is going to think, well, I could never use that because I never run 8.2 PHP. I always run 8.3.4, and I will not run something that doesn't let me choose that. Well, then that's fine. You know, then Unihost probably isn't for that mythical person, whereas a lot of other people, and I mean, I'll admit there's probably a time and a place, because like, look, I probably wouldn't take Unihost to work, not because I don't trust Unihost, but because if someone says, hey, we need WordPress, and I click the install button on Unihost to install WordPress, and for whatever reason it fails, Then I mean, yes, it's, look, Unihost is open source. I could do the troubleshooting. I could figure it out, but it would be, I think, easier for me, quicker for me to simply have a server, know what I need to do for WordPress, do all the different setup steps, and then install WordPress. And if it fails, then I know the problem. I know that the problem is between me and WordPress because I've already verified that the database is working because I created all the tables and I can look at those and they're there. So the failure is this and this, you know. So you can get very sort of specific. I mean, and I say I probably wouldn't take it to work, but it depends on the work, you know. Like at a certain point, at a certain price point, I might take it to work because that might just make more sense. Like if I've got a lot to do during the day and I'm being underpaid anyway, and they need a WordPress site and a wiki and a video conferencing software by the end of day, then maybe Unihost is the right answer. So I kind of think it does probably depend. And I guess it depends on how much you want to get into that open source aspect of it too. I mean, like I say, Unihost is open source. You can learn the system. You can look at the packaging details. You can look at what's controlling what, you know, and find all the configuration files that are being transferred over and how all that works. You can be a part of the solution if something breaks. So there's no shame in that either. But I think for a lot of people, Unihost is just a really, really convenient way to run public services. I mean, it isn't an appliance that you buy from the store and just turn on and suddenly have a Nextcloud, which, I mean, there's an argument for that too. And Nextcloud does sell hosted instances. You could do that. That's the true appliance. You throw money at it and it appears. And there's a absolutely an argument for that. And I would do that in a heartbeat if I needed to, or if I just felt like it. It's a great option to have. But Unihost is I guess right in between there, right? It's not an appliance off the shelf, but you're also not building it yourself. It's somewhere in between. And it's a great little project. I mean, I think, as I was saying at the end of 561, I guess it was, about Dovecot. I mean, this is important. Like, this is the important kind of thing where if we want to have open source networked, you know, the network is your computer. Is it open source? Well, if we want it to be open source, things like Unihost, which allows us, you and me, to run our own services, that's really important. Our own open source services, that's important. So Unihost, Turnkey Linux, that's another good one. Although that's gotten really, really deep into containers now. So, or virtual machines, maybe both. So you do have to have kind of a certain setup for that, I think, to kind of be still as easy as maybe it ought to be. You know, there's sort of a barrier to entry there. Unihost, I feel, is actually a step down. I mean, really the only barrier to entry there is, can you follow instructions on installing this thing? Can you navigate the nightmare maze that is DNS and dynamic DNS and routing the signal from your router to your device and so on? If you can do all of that, then you're in Unihost and you're just hosting applications. You don't even have to think about it. It's just happening. So it's a really, really cool service. You should, or project rather. You should try it. You should run some stuff. You know, I mean, test it out, get used to it, find its faults, find the things that that it can't handle. Yeah, and I've had Unihost break on me. I've installed just the right combination of applications that just kind of things fall apart and it just doesn't work out. So don't build something that you absolutely need right away. Test it, try it, audition it, you know, test it out, find what works for you, and then lean into that and see what happens. If you start building things that you rely on, do your backups. There's a backup button right there on the admin interface. Do your backups, make sure that everything's backed up and reliable, that you can screw things up while you're playing around and recover later. Do all that stuff, but definitely try Unihost if you're at all curious about administering a server that provides usable applications for your friends and family. It's a very, very satisfying thing. Unihost.org. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.